4:20 p.m. Eastern Time, we have our man, Mr. Edward Vieira, Jr. We're talking about pieces of eight. We're talking about the monetary powers and disabilities and disabilities, folks, of the United States Constitution. We're talking about honest money, and we're talking about what type of money we have right now. Edward, how you doing?
Just fine, Tom. How are you today?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for asking. So, you know, last week we were talking about, you know, just, you know, what the money's all about, what we can do with it. You know, when you look at what's happening out here, right, meaning that the education of the public and, you know, as the banks just keep raking money off the top, what's the next move? What's the next move for, you know, the citizens of this great United States to take back their monetary system?
Well, it doesn't look as if there's any groundswell of enthusiasm or knowledge directed towards taking back the monetary system, because most people don't seem to understand that it's been taken away from them in the first place.
Right.
What they really have to worry about, I think, is a movement towards some kind of globalization beyond what we already have of the currency system, so that it gets even further away from control by the people. I mean, we've moved from direct control by Congress to this indirect control by the Federal Reserve System, which of course is dominated by not governmental. And the next step will be to remove that further to a globalist system so that it will be essentially completely out of control of Congress. Congress still has some oversight authority. Of course, it has complete oversight authority. It doesn't exercise it to a very great degree. But once the system is moved into a global framework, then, of course, you can write Congress off as being completely irrelevant.
Boy, it seems that's the way we're going, too, doesn't it?
Yes, it looks as if that's the plan in terms of the people in international finance who are calling the shots here. And, of course, the Federal Reserve System became, to a large degree, a globalist system simply because of the position of the United States after World War II and the Bretton Woods Agreement, and that the Federal Reserve note was essentially the only world currency, or the only currency that was stable enough
yes.
to be a world currency. Now we're seeing the development of the euro, and there's a possibility for that to emerge. That's another problem that's coming forward, is there are inherent instabilities in this system, no matter what the powers that be may believe about the ability to manage fiat money. There are inherent instabilities. And that's the other side of the coin, that some of those instabilities may begin to manifest themselves before these moves towards a globalist structure occur.
And that would be the only thing that would actually stop that global structure, wouldn't it?
Well, I think so. That would set the timetable back. Awaken people as to the significance of this monetary problem, number one, and number two, that they have to do something about it domestically here within the United States to get control of it before it's taken out of our hands entirely.
You know, it's intriguing today, and this is another subject, but folks, something to understand, okay, that the basis of our money is, you know, if you have the Constitution, but the basis of the money that, you know, as Edward said, no one's paying attention to it, and they've already hijacked that. And as they hijacked that, of course, they hijacked the Constitution. And I was watching today, I was actually, a quick news.
Goodbye!
Our Secretary of Defense, he wants power to basically get rid of civil servants. You know, it's a grab for power, basically, in the Defense Department. And, you know, I heard that, and I'm saying to myself, okay, hold it. You know, and not that, you know, civil servants and bureaucracies, I have a problem with them to a certain point, but I have a bigger problem. Because when I see that, I'm saying, okay, that's a perfect way, okay, that you give one person that type of power, you destroy the civil servants, you destroy the bureaucracy inside it. Well, right away, that's another grab to go into a globalization type of deal, you know.
That's right. You notice, Tom, the evolution of this whole process is away from representative government and into the hands of an elite whether that elite is in an administrative agency, whether it's in the executive department of government, or whether it's in the Federal Reserve context, of course, a banking cartel.
Yes.
But first, get it away from the people. Get it away from the people's representatives. Turn it over to appointed individuals, or in the case of the Federal Reserve, to a large extent, those people there, we have no choice as to who they are at all because the private banks select them. And you see that movement away from representative government in every area. It's not just in the monetary field, but now you're seeing it in the area of so-called homeland security. You've seen it for years in the area of regulatory agencies in this country, and it's something that's developing a real momentum of its own. And once, as I said before, once that begins to move to the globalist level, once we begin to see globalist institutions like the UN or what's going to be following the UN come into line and begin making these decisions, then we're in very serious trouble because we'll have no representative ability to regain control over those situations.
As an attorney, right, do you see any type of movement? See, the way that I look at this is that what happened, folks, in this country was found that the really founding fathers were in the law. And you never win anything basically in the streets except a lot of greed. Are there any other attorneys that are involved, that would take up these stands also?
Well, in the monetary field, there are very, very few. This subject is not taught in law schools. It's certainly not something that you see being litigated every day. The few cases that have come up have been pretty much poo-pooed. Any of this stuff is being essentially frivolous information. I think, to a great extent, that's because they're terrifically ignorant of the subject. It's not necessarily conspiratorial. It's just the fact they've been brought up with a mindset that says this is all water over the dam and it's of no consequence.
It's not a big deal, right?
That's right. And now, in terms, though, of what we're seeing in the so-called homeland security area, where more and more powers are being absorbed by the executive branch of government, where we're seeing attacks on the Fifth Amendment, on the Fourth Amendment, on the Sixth Amendment, coming out of the defense establishment, that may begin to wake people up.
Yeah.
Because there's still a lingering concern about those issues. And then, of course, once we see debate open in that area, it may spill over, and of course, in the monetary field.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the monetary field can kill you. The monetary field can kill you in two ways. Number one, because it has this momentum that's moving in the direction of centralization, bureaucratization, globalization. And on the other hand, because it's inherently unstable and could collapse or implode, if you will, at almost any time, thereby throwing the whole country into a crisis situation that would dwarf the September 11th business.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because it takes everyone's livelihood.
That's right.
That's the bottom line. And what happens, folks, you want to grasp, okay, what Edwin's saying here, and I can tell you, folks, okay, he has a couple books, okay, this one we're talking about, Pieces of Eight. You go to TFNN, you just go to the contributor page, I got a link right over to Edwin's page, and it's two, if you're into history, if you're into money, it is a phenomenal reference that really can teach you a lot about not only where we are now, but what was supposed to happen and what the actual disabilities are. And, can you speak a little about the disabilities of the Constitution? I know, we have a lot of new listeners, and we did this the first time, but that really intrigues me.
Yes, Tom, that's a fundamentally important point to understand. Everyone, I suppose, takes it as a given that this is a more or less free society.
Yes.
Well, to have a free society, you have to have a limited government. Because a government that is unlimited or totalitarian is the essence of a police state, right?
Yes.
All right, you have to have a limited government. Well, a limited government is a government that has some powers removed from it. There are some things it cannot do. It has some disabilities, all right?
Right.
That's the key. Our Constitution was written not only to give the government certain powers, but to make sure that it had certain disabilities. And actually, there are probably more disabilities in there. Because the power of the national government, of Congress, of the president, of the judiciary, is limited to what the Constitution delegates. And everything else is prohibited.
Right.
Everything else is prohibited. And now we have a mindset coming on in Washington, which is exactly the opposite of that, which says, well, we can do whatever we want unless you can find some prohibition in the Constitution? Does it violate the First Amendment? Does it violate the Fifth Amendment? Can you find something specific that says we can't do this? And that, of course, turns the whole concept, as the Founding Fathers put it on paper, upside down and inside out.
Unbelievable. It really is unbelievable.
And it's extremely dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because those people in Washington can certainly think up power after power after power if nobody is in a position to challenge them.
You know what is amazing here, and you're seeing this more after Iraq. You're seeing, you know, of course, the theory out there, whether it's the Democrats or Republicans, when it comes down to the elite structure that we're talking about, folks, they're all the same. Okay, you know, the last thing they'd want is one party out there, because then each and every one of us can say, okay, we got a dictatorship going on, or they're forcing it down our throat. But what I have noticed in a huge way, you know, after Iraq, well, you know, of course, the Democrats this thing. It's like, you know, and I guess, you know, I mean, I know, you know, seeing politicians for so long, besides the, you know, out of the finance business, I mean, I figure the, you know, the political business is the toughest business in the world, and unfortunately, it's not on the level, you know. But the elite structure that is going on, Ed, do you feel that it's a structure that is being passed down, or it's a structure that is opened, you know, to so many people as they just step up to these different banks and, you know, these different international organizations?
Well, I think the strength of this structure is precisely that there is an element of openness to it. They bring in talented people.
Yeah, right.
They convert them to their way of thinking early on, maybe in college or perhaps even earlier. Clinton, Strobe Talbot, some of these other people from that administration are certainly type people of that type in the Bush, in both Bush administrations.
Yes.
They monitor, they pick out people who have talent, they groom them, they give them the right mindset, then they bring them in and work them through various positions, maybe in government, the famous revolving door, right? They're in government in some agency, then they go off and they're in some corporate position, they're in some think tank or what, bank or what have you, and then they're back into government around and around. How many times have we seen that with the same people, year after year, musical chairs, they're in one administration and another administration? That is not an accident. These are not the only talented people in this country. But they're the ones who think within the box, if you understand what I mean.
Folks, you got to understand what Ed is saying here, and I can tell you from flat out, from growing up in Boston, I can tell you flat out, not only the politicians, but the politicians and the gangsters did the exact same thing. Ed, I mean, I can tell you stories that would put your hair up on fire. You wouldn't believe it. And what you're saying, I flat out, okay, you know, 15, 16, 17 years old, Both sides of that coin, okay, would go after the bright and the smartest. And the thing that's amazing, actually, is that they both would push them, whether it's Boston College or Harvard or, you know, Dartmouth or something. But that's actually a scary thought, because it's, when you get the best and brightest and, you know, you get them trained correctly, forget it, you know. It's wild. Unbelievable.
That's right. That's exactly right. And especially when the people on top are in a position to open doors for those younger ones as they're coming along. And so their careers are being made on the basis of their following the game plan that's set for them by the people above. See how that works?
Oh.
It's the carrot and the stick. It's Pavlov's dog.
Listen,
You're training people and giving them rewards to the extent that they fulfill the functions you want them to fulfill, so it's natural that they develop in a certain course.
Absolutely. Unbelievable. That is absolutely unbelievable. Wild. Listen, folks, it's Pieces of Eight. Okay, check it out at TFNN. Go to the contributor page. Every Wednesday, 4:20, we're going to get our update here. And this is really fabulous. You know what is really wild? Is that it's like, okay, you know, they build this out, and, you know, they have, I mean, it's really slavery. It's financial slavery that they keep everyone on the hamster wheel, keep them going, and, you know, they got the United States down pat. Now they get in Europe. I mean, this, you know, this is where I guess where you can see that, you know, wars do get made over, you know, if there's two different structures happening. One, you know, they both know the same deal. They both know that they just want to basically control the masses. You know,
that's right.
That's wild.
Absolutely. We're in for lots of trouble, Tom.
Yeah. Well, you know, what we can do here, folks, is this. That one of the keys is to understand what the system is. And, you know what I really liked about even your introduction to your book, Edward, that you knew, and I was talking to you, folks, this is going to be a long time, but it can be fought, and it can be fought through the education and the communication field, okay? And what you want to do with this, okay, you want to get your head into it. You want, when you're sitting down with your friends, when you're sitting down with your family, when you're sitting down with your community, you want to ask those questions. And you want to take these politicians, and what you want to do with the politicians, I would say, is this. There's many of them that I've even interviewed myself, and they don't understand it, and that's as sick as you can get, because all they understand is the soft money that's coming in. So the people that are running are smart enough to make sure that they know, they listen, get them educated, because there are still a lot of good people out there that do want to serve the government, that do want to, you know, be in those positions of power, and you have to get it into their head that, listen, this is a good country, this is a great country, and let's do something about it. Let's not lose it, because if we lose it, you know, the bottom line is that all the blood that's been shed over the years by the young men and women that have got us here, okay, goes down the drain. And each and every one of us have a responsibility to do our best and to take that responsibility seriously. Edward, thank you so much. Really appreciate it, man.
Thank you, Tom.
Have a great one. It's Edward Vieira, folks, okay? It's Pieces of Eight, the Monetary Powers and Disabilities of the United States Constitution. Check it out. It is absolutely fabulous book. It's two books. It's 1,600 pages. It's only $59, folks, okay? It's a passion of love. That's what he's looking at. This is Tom O'Brien. This is Tiger Financial News Network. We have Steve Woods coming up next at floatanalysis.com. We're going to be right back, folks. Every Wednesday, we have our man, Mr. Edward Vieira Jr., a constitutional lawyer, a great author, many books, actually. The book that we've been going over is Pieces of Eight, The Monetary Powers and Disabilities of the United States. Edward, how are you doing?
How are you?
Good. Hey, somebody asked you, I heard you gave an unbelievable speech at the New York Rotary Club. Tell us about it.
Well,
Word travels, Edward. You know, you're getting that message out there, man.
Yeah, I'm surprised that you'd heard about that.
Isn't that wild?
Sure. For folks who are internet savvy, you should take a look at the FAME, FAME.org website. That's the Foundation for the Advancement of Monetary Education. It's run by a fellow by the name of Larry Parks.
Yep.
From New York City. And he is a member of the Rotary Club, among other organizations up there. And he arranged to have me come up and give a talk at one of their lunch sessions to people who primarily didn't know very much of anything about monetary issues or constitutional law or the history of our money and banking systems. And they were very, very interested in it, which tells me something, that once this message is presented to people, they understand.
Absolutely.
Our problem is that they're not hearing it.
Yeah, exactly. And folks, if you've never been to a Rotary Club meeting, I can tell you, Rotary Clubs, you should get involved with them in your communities. They're absolutely dynamic. These are the people that have businesses in your communities. These are the people that care about your communities. These are the people that raise money. It's not a political organization, folks. What it is it's a social type of organization that they, my experience has been that they're really nice people, and they're always doing something for the community. You know what's great here, Edward, is that those types of people, and I can imagine, because folks, there's people that are liberal, they're conservative, but they're not the type of person that you think that, you know, is going to be out protesting and say, oh my God. But once it gets into their head, these people can be dangerous, because it's wild, you know, that you got the speaker, number one, but, you know, what the response was unreal, right?
Well, I think so, and the other thing that impressed me was that those people are something of a cross-section of the community.
Yes, they are.
In terms of the economy, in terms of business, in terms of social life, and to talk to, and that speech went on, I suppose, for about an hour,
yep.
40 minutes to an hour, and to talk to them and receive the very positive feedback that I did at the end of the talk was very encouraging.
That's
because I said most of them had never heard any of this type of thing before.
Absolutely. And that is great news. That is absolutely great news. I saw that. I actually got the email from Larry. And folks, go to fame.org, because you can actually get, in fact, you know what, you can get Pieces of Eight, folks, Edwin's bio's on our site, and what I'll, you know what I'll do? I'll attach that same thing so I can get them right over to Larry, because I got an email from Larry, and that's, that's how I knew, but that the whole speech is right on there, folks. Absolutely.
Right, and then there was another one. Larry is a real go-getter. I gave a talk a little later at the New York University Club.
Oh, you did? Oh,
and
cool.
that will be up on the FAME website as well.
Oh, that's, you're really getting out there. You're getting that message out there.
I hope so.
That's fabulous. So, you know, right now, what do you think? You know, first off, I guess, you know, we've been going over how the monetary, you know, system started. Basically, you know, that when you kind of take a look at how we got to where we are, it seems to me that everyone that, you know, between our congressmen and our senators that we elect, no one's doing their job.
Well, that's quite correct. And actually, if you go back historically, you'll see that especially during the 1930s, when we had the great, what I would call the great divide in separation of the government from basic constitutional principles as the result primarily of, you know, the economic catastrophe that occurred with the Great Depression, the banking collapse in 1929 and the early 1930s. That was one point at which you saw very clearly, at least which I saw, it's covered in my book in great detail, how Congress essentially abdicated its responsibility and left a tremendous, or gave a tremendous amount of power, really, to the executive branch of government, looking more and more for leadership from that one man, from the president.
Right.
And you especially see this in the early 1930s. And, of course, that has developed and gone on and, if you will, evolved into a situation now, certainly, where almost every area of consequence in American life, you think about the economy, you're thinking about direction from the White House. What's the White House going to do about this? You're thinking about national security. What's the White House going to do about this? You're thinking about international affairs. What's the White House going to do about this? But if you read the Constitution, you'll see that outside of the specific power of the president to be, of course, the commander-in-chief, which is a kind of quasi-military position that he holds, that is Congress that really has constitutional power, not the president.
And they don't use it. I mean,
and they don't use it.
Well, you know, the war in Iraq is a perfect situation. You know what I can't wait for? I cannot wait. You know, what's going on is that we're headquartered in New Hampshire. And, of course, every presidential candidate, that's where they're going to be. And I can't wait to interview them, and I can't wait to ask a few of these congressmen. Number one, you know, why, you know, you didn't vote on it. I don't, it doesn't matter to me which way, you know, they want to vote, but why didn't you vote on it, right? And now, you know, after the fact, of course, you know, everyone's complaining about it. Well, you know, what are you going to complain about? You know, you didn't want to vote on it. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you want it both ways? Of course, we know they want it both ways. You
right.
know what I mean?
And now you look at the tremendous difference. Let's go back to the Roosevelt administration, where really this kind of congressional abdication came to the fore. They were giving the Roosevelt administration all sorts of essentially unilateral powers from Congress. Even then, you had the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. What did Franklin Roosevelt do? He came to Congress and asked for a declaration of war. Now, clearly, we were at war with Japan. They had attacked us, right?
Right.
One would almost look at that and say, well, declaration of war is kind of a superfluous thing. They've attacked us. What else can we do, the situation in which we find ourselves? But in that particular situation, following the Constitution, as he had taken an oath to do, he came before Congress, asked for a declaration of war, and received it. Now, here we have a situation. See how far we've evolved.
Exactly.
Here we have a situation. You can take it one way or the other, whether you believe that, you know, Iraq was a specific national security threat or wasn't. That was the position that was taken by the administration. And if that was the truth, the short constitutional answer was you go to Congress, you receive a declaration of war, and then you proceed on that basis. And here we have Congress not even doing that.
Exactly.
Although it seems fairly clear to me that if President Bush had asked for a declaration of war, he probably would have gotten one.
And that would have been okay. I mean, the way I look at, you know, the way that the setup is, I mean, I, you know, it's like, okay, the more they can get away without doing it, the more that they can get away with executive orders, okay? And folks, when Edwin was starting off here, just so you can understand how we are evolving, okay, what is happening is that the federal government, but, you know, it wasn't supposed to take care of each and every one of our needs, okay? This is the United States of America, okay? We have states' rights, we have federal rights, and then what has transpired now is that, forget the states' rights and federal rights into the Constitution. What has happened, and this is where we bring back to the beginning of Pieces of Eight, monetary powers and disabilities, is that they've given up our rights, and they've given up really to the Fed, and now what ends up happening is we have a dishonest money system.
And it's very interesting because when you look, what shall I say, from the point of view of political philosophy, it's always said that government has to have two great powers in order to fulfill its function. Number one is the power of the purse. It has to be able to tax and spend money. And secondly, the power of the sword. It has to be able to deal with international situations in terms of war and domestic situations, of course, in terms of some kind of police power. All right, the power to control the purse, what has happened to that? It has gone from the people, from the states, from the constitutional powers and disabilities into what? Into the hands of the Federal Reserve System. And to a very large extent, we know the Federal Reserve System tends to reflect the abilities or disabilities, if you will, of one particular man, the chairman of the Board of Governors, right?
Right.
Everyone knows Greenspan. Everyone knew Volcker. You can list a half a dozen of the famous chairman of the Federal Reserve. Name five other people from the Board of Governors.
Absolutely.
Right. Very, 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 very difficult. So here we have all the money powers of our system. Now, I won't say of the Constitution because it's unconstitutional, the Federal Reserve System, but those money powers are now centralized in a system which depends upon the leadership of one man. And then we look in the area of the economy, of war and peace, of foreign policy. We see all of those powers, again, concentrated in the hands of one man, in this case, the president. Now, there's a word for that kind of a system, or there's a phrase for that kind of a system, where you concentrate powers in the hands of one man. It's called the leader principle. All right? You have a leader who gives direction to the entire system. In the past, it might have been called a monarchy, but the last century, in the 20th century, it's called the leader principle. And there's a foreign language in which it's perhaps best expressed. It's das Führer Prinzip.
Right.
All right? Das Führer Prinzip. All right? The Führer, the leadership principle. And that's what we're seeing developing. If we've gone from a republic, a diversified republic, a federal republic, where most powers were at the state and local level, and the federal aspect of it, the national aspect, covered only those matters which truly had national or international scope attached to them. And slowly but surely, and then accelerating from the 1930s on, more and more of those powers have been sucked away from the state and local level and gone to Washington, and then within Washington, they've been concentrated in the executive branch and in the hands of one or two men, such as a Greenspan in the Board of Governors, or a president, whether it's Bush, Carter, whatever, somebody there in the White House. And that, when you think about that historically, you have to recognize that that's an extremely unsettling and perhaps dangerous trend.
And that, you know, that, folks, we're not talking a lot of years here that this has happened. I mean, you know, it's really incredible. When I think, I'm 52 years old, and when I think of just certain rights, okay, that people don't even understand they have now. Edwin, you know what blows my mind is that it's got so entrenched that, you know, I think really folks maybe even younger than 40 don't even realize what some of their rights are at all. I mean, at all. And the only reason I do is growing up in South Boston, of course, you know, it was a highly, you know, political place, and the bottom line is that people were independent, and, you know, if someone walked up to you and sat off your kitchen and say, hey, go, you know, go somewhere else, you know. And now people think they have to answer questions. They think that if a government official just says something, do you have to answer it? It's like, what are you talking about? You're working for me. Go somewhere else.
Right. There are two aspects to that. Number one is how little they know. And that's, in a sense, a matter of education and historical understanding. And they don't have knowledge of the way this country was 20, 30, 50, 100 years ago and what's happened in this evolutionary process. But to me, always the more unsettling side of it is they don't seem to care. Monetary field, but constitutionalism in general.
Yes.
And many, many times I'll get sort of a shrug in the shoulders of the shoulders, and they'll say, "Well, what difference does that make to me? I'm all right. I can do what I want to do. Why should I be worried about that?"
Yeah. And the unfortunate part about it, it's always leave it onto someone else. How's that going to make me more money? How's that going to do this? How's that going to do that? And folks, you know, the bottom line, we have a great country. And, you know, when you look at the, have you seen We Were Soldiers yet by any chance? That movie?
No.
You got to see that movie. Oh my God. It was, when We Were Soldiers, if you haven't seen it yet, folks, this is what it's about. It's about the first men in the 7th Regiment in the Army that they sent into Vietnam. It is such a sad movie. It's unbelievable. Just, these guys are heroes. It was just unbelievable. My point is this, folks, okay? Over the course of the years, there's many men, there's many women. Edwin himself, he's out there. He doesn't have to be doing this to get people educated. We get a dynamite country, folks, okay? But what's going on is that we, each and every one of us, collectively, okay, are letting the elite, and the elite folks can have a thousand different definitions, okay? What it is, it's a group of people or organizations, okay, that are taking away, number one, you're taking away your monetary rights, they're taking away your rights, and it's escalating. And, you know, I want to tell you today, folks, you email marvin@tfnn.com. I got a bunch of copies of the Constitution. You email it today, we'll send out everyone one. Edwin, what else can we do? What else can we do to get this thing cooking?
Well, I don't know if it's a what else. We have to go back to that basic concept of education. This country was built upon the concept of self-government. If you let somebody else govern your life, you are not governing your own life. It's as simple as that, all right? Limited government. If you let the government continue to absorb more and more power, it has to do that at the expense of your freedom. It's two sides of the same coin, right? More power, less freedom.
Yeah.
More freedom, less power. Now, the third element here is education. People have to understand that equation of power. They have to understand what their responsibility is in terms of self-government. They have to get the historical knowledge to see what's happened. They have to get some of the theoretical knowledge to understand what our government was meant to be and where it's been taken off track. And then they begin, to be kind of blunt, they have to begin opening their mouths about this.
Right, absolutely.
All right. If we're all going to sit back and quietly accept it, then the other side, those people that you're calling the elitists, are going to do whatever they want to do.
Oh, absolutely. Listen, folks, okay, it's a no-brainer for them, right? They sit there and laugh. I got to tell you something. You know, you go out to California, when you see the people, they're driving for an hour and a half, 2 hours every single day. Anyone that is manipulating markets or dollars, they go out there and say, listen, I got it made. I got all these slaves out here. They're just slaving all day long for me. Listen, folks, give Marvin an email if you want to copy the Constitution. It's marvin@tfnn.com. Book, Pieces of Eight. Check it out at TFNN. Just go to the contributor page. You'll hook right onto Edwin Vieira, and you'll get right over it. Two volumes, folks. It's a masterpiece. Edwin, thanks so much. Look forward
thanks,
to seeing you next week.
Talk to you next week.
Great one, absolutely. This is Tom O'Brien, the Sack and Finish News Network. We're going to be right back, folks. Money, and right now we got our man is explaining our money system to each and every week. Dr. Edwin Vieira, Pieces of Eight, absolutely fabulous book, folks. And folks, you can go to our website at tfnn.com. Go to the contributor page. You just hit Dr. Edwin Vieira, and there's a link going right into his page. And the bottom line is that if you want a book that not only will give you a great education, but as a reference authority, it is absolutely incredible. It's two books and it's approximately 1,700 pages and it's absolutely unreal. Edwin, how you doing?
Very good, Tom. How are you today?
Great, great. So, hey, listen, what do you think about this rate cut and what do you think about what's happening out here?
Well, I don't think of anything with respect to the rate cut in particular because I never make economic prognostications. That's for folks like you who are watching the markets day to day and hour to hour. But let's go back to some fundamentals here so people see how this all fits in.
Great.
The Federal Reserve System was set up primarily, I would say, that the subterranean purpose of it was to redistribute wealth through manipulation of money and credit, to do something the market was not going to do in terms of real holdings of wealth through the mechanism of the sleight of hand, if you will, the smoke and mirrors of this very complicated banking apparatus that was established. Now, that kind of redistribution of wealth would go in two directions. One, it would also... hidden taxation.
I
the
see.
Ability of government to redistribute wealth to itself by monetization of public debt. But what a lot of people don't realize, the banking system also engages in redistributions of wealth within society itself, what many economists would call false or forced savings. They're also false savings. Redistribution of wealth in society into the capital markets for the purpose of what I would call quasi-investment. I call it quasi-investment because it's not investment that the market really wants, either in total or in particular areas. It's investments that the banks and the bank's particular clients and maybe the politicians in the background want. So when you see Mr. Greenspan coming out and cutting rates, and they've been cutting rates for a long, long time, haven't they?
Absolutely.
The goal there is to keep the stock market, the economy, pumped up as much as possible, in really in contradiction of some things that, that the markets would be doing by themselves spontaneously if it weren't for the intervention of the banks and the government. Now, what does that do? In the long run, it injects a certain level of non-rationality. That is investment of capital, redistribution of wealth, that the market is not making based on all of the data that the market has, but that this central banking group, the Federal Open Market Committee, is making on the basis of the very limited data that it has, comparatively speaking, because a lot of what goes on in the market never gets into that committee to study. And secondly, based on political considerations, which almost by definition are non-rational. So what you have in the long run is a false allocation of capital. And really that amounts to a derangement of the market. The market is now operating on false data based upon the intervention of this banking cartel and the government behind it. And in the long run, that is going to lead to economic dislocation. And here's the other side of that coin. In the long run, it will lead to the ineffectiveness of this monetary redistribution mechanism. All right? And that's what you see happening. I mean, how much have they been cutting rates, and cutting rates is now as low as it's been in, what, 50 years?
Yes.
I can't remember, approximately 50 years. And they, I think, are getting to the point of what some people call pushing on a string, right? They can inject and inject and inject as much new liquidity, they can lower interest rates as much as they want, but they are not going to see a real effect in terms of real expansion of the economy. They may expand the bubble, but they're not going to expand the production of real goods and services that will have a lasting, long-term beneficial effect on society. They may have a short-term beneficial effect on the particular clients of the bank, and there's always somebody who makes money out of this if they play their cards right. But in terms of society as a whole, it is not going to do that, and the more they continue these injections of false capital, the more they lay the groundwork for real trouble down the line. I'm not going to predict when it's going to happen, but you know as well as I do it's going to happen.
This is incredible. Folks, I want you to follow along here. This is incredible. I got to tell you, Edwin, you are fabulous as to how you explain things, because I understand quite a bit, just even with the Fed, but the relationship, you know, all of us, I think, wonder that, okay, how did the Fed get away with this, number one, and how do they do it? But when you just came up and said, well, you know, it's hidden taxation also. It's the Fed, it's the government, it's the politicians, it's all one ball of wax, so that there is a certain amount of people that can go forward. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, when I have other people on here, and unfortunately, many economists that think it's real, you know, they say to me, well, Tom, you know, like on this bounce out here, right? Everyone's saying that, hey, this bounce can't happen. I said, well, of course it can, because the market's not real anyway. I mean, I come from the basis that none of it's real. You know what I mean? So it's like, hold it. Of course it can bounce. I mean, this is just they're putting money into the system, and if people have money, so they're going to go spend it. You know what I mean?
That's the purpose.
I can see it's the purpose, right. And the real question, do you think, like, and I'm looking at this, you know, the time, you know, well, we got away with it in 98, bar none, the system had fell apart. I actually, Edward, right behind me, I have something on my board, and this is something that wasn't in the public, but it is in the public domain, and you can get it at the SEC, actually, that, you know, we had the 98 meltdown with long-term capital, that Merrill Lynch was actually broke. And they got fined, okay?
Right.
They went under net capital, and on the filing, I saw this come across Bloomberg. I took it off, and I said, hold it, this can't be right, right? Well, what happened is this. When we had the meltdown in July, right, is that every broker-dealer, of course, is supposed to have so much money on hand, right? Well, Merrill Lynch went under, and they didn't know whether they went under from $1 billion to $3 billion. This is a public record, okay? I got the print, and I'm saying to myself, I can't believe this. Well, they only got fined $200,000. They didn't have any money. Okay? So I looked at it, I said to myself, oh, my God. And my point is this, folks, okay? We were under at that particular point, but what happened is that they got it back together again, so, you know, we were all right, thank God. I mean, in essence, okay? So now we come to this point here. You know, do you think we'll get away with it this time? I mean, how long do you think we can get away with it for? Because in one of these days, it's going to fall apart.
Well, but there's exactly the point. I mean, here you're talking about Merrill Lynch, and there's a factor of $2 billion that they are unsure of.
Right.
Which is rather a significant amount of wealth. Those people are trying to operate on the most rational principles they can, obviously, because they're trying to make money out of the stock market, and yet they have a $2 billion plus or minus error built into their own system. What this tells me immediately is, well, there's something of significant irrationality with which those folks are dealing.
And that's what they put out, that's what's in the filing. You know, when I saw that in the filing, I says, okay, if they're saying, it says exactly $1 billion to $3 billion. So I says, okay, if it says that in the filing, what was it really? You know what I mean? It's like, okay, this is public information.
Right. And do they really know? And the point here is, this is very much like the human body. You're overtaxing the human body with drinking, with, you know, alcohol, with smoking, with a lack of exercise, come down with some kind of a heart ailment. All right, you go and you get some injection of new drugs or whatever, and it keeps you going a little while longer. But if you continue those underlying pathological behaviors, if you continue to drink, if you continue to smoke, if you continue to be the couch potato that never exercises at all while he's eating a high cholesterol diet or what have you, you are going to have these recurrent and increasingly severe episodes, which at some point, the medical establishment, in this case the Federal Reserve is the analogy, is not going to be able to come in with synthetic drugs or other kinds of treatments to put you back on track. You're going to go into an extreme crisis mode. And that's the problem, because the Federal Reserve here, unlike the medical establishment, is really always injecting levels of further irrationality into the system. At some point, the medical establishment at least can come in and give you triple bypass surgery, right?
Right.
And that will cure, to the extent surgery cures the underlying disease, it will cure that. So there's rationality built into the way the medical establishment operates, even completely out of bounds in terms of the way he handles his health. But in terms of the economy, you're looking at the Federal Reserve System and the government, which are some of the primary causes of the problem, and saying those people are our last resorts for the solution.
Yeah.
You see, the non-rationality is even built into the structure of the mechanism.
Oh, listen, this brings me to this question, right? Do you think, you know, I've been kind of thinking about what's happening between the monetary system, between us, you know, being the next dictators of the world, and I'm saying to myself, okay, what is it all about? Well, it seems to me that we're going after resources. And when I look at resources, it's like, okay, the resources are the only thing we need. I mean, is that what it's all about here? I mean,
well, let's look at one thing. In order to rationalize the constant increases of the banking bubble, if you'll allow me to call it that, you have to have not only injections of the phony money and credit on the one side, but you have to be able to justify that with injections of real goods and resources on the other.
Right.
So the reality is, if you're going to continue to justify, to rationalize this huge paper establishment that's been created, your economy had bloody well had better have access to real goods, services, and ultimately resources, because without the resources, you can't generate the goods and services.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're right. If you're looking at a country that is based upon monetary imperialism, which essentially is what the Federal Reserve has been doing since World War II, since the Bretton Woods Agreement, right, which made the Federal Reserve known to be the currency of the reserve. If you're going to work on a system of monetary imperialism, you better start looking over your shoulder and figure out how you're going to have goods and services imperialism, resources imperialism, to go along with it.
This is unbelievable, because that's the road we're on right now.
That's right. You look at the big picture, and that's what you're seeing happening. And if you turn back and say, well, why is this going on? Is it because they want to create democracy in the third world? I mean, you know, all these explanations that are given. No, the reality is it's being driven by this system, this Frankenstein's monster that was created over here,
yes,
that we cannot get rid of without facing a terrible crisis.
And it comes all the way back to the bankers and the Fed. This is a trip. You know what's unbelievable? Something that I you may have seen this week, which actually blew my mind. I mean, the New York Times is normally a liberal newspaper, right? You know, it, in essence, I see it as a liberal newspaper anyway. So what is in there this weekend, right? Was it weekend or Monday? I forget what day it was. Well, you know, they had one article about Halliburton and you know, Kellogg and you know, Brown and Root or whatever the name of that company is, you know,
right.
and they were the consultants to make the parameters for the contract, and of course they made it that only themselves could get it, right? So that was one article in the New York Times. Then we're talking billions, right? But then the editorial absolutely blew my mind. And what the editorial was about was about myself. What is going on here, man? Are these people crazy? I mean, I look at the Constitution, I'm saying to myself, and I look at all the, you know, the young men and women in the service, I'm saying to myself, hold it. Where is it saying in here that, you know, we have the right to bust through every border there is? And that was the editorial in the New York Times, saying to myself, okay, now what seems to be happening is that, you know, that the big press, including the Times, is getting on board here in a big way, too.
Oh, well, I think so, because they see the direction in which it's going. If you look at the Constitution, let's bring this back to basic principle. The preamble of the Constitution sets out the fundamental purposes for which the whole government is set up.
Right.
And one of them is the common defense. Now, focus on that word, the common defense, not world imperialism.
That's right.
Not wars of aggression, not wars of conquest for resources, but the common defense. So if you look at this whole policy, and I'm not going to blame Bush specifically, because this happened under Clinton, and they're going into Bosnia and the Balkans and so forth and so on.
Yes.
This has been going on for quite some time.
Okay, this is a great point you're making. This is what you have to get in your head. This is what this book's about. This goes back to the banking structure, and the thing is so corrupt that it can corrupt. It doesn't matter. It's a Democrat, Republican. If when you're part of it, it's the whole deal. It's not just one particular animal up there.
That's exactly the problem. Fundamentally misguided governmental policies, as long as they are driven by the agenda of this economic structure that's lying in the background.
And, you know, each and every one of us, okay? You know, you let certain things go. Well, the bottom line is that each and every, they love it. Whoever, you know, is pulling, they love it when you let one thing go. Why? Because then that chips down the next one. And each and every one of our generations, I can tell you flat out, know a lot less about it. And you know, it's great what you're doing out here. It really is.
Well, it's what you're doing, Tom, that ignorance is the great danger.
It really is.
You cannot run a society as complicated as this one, as large as this one, with the public, which supposedly is in control, right? It's supposedly a democracy, right?
Yeah.
They vote for their representatives. If they don't know the answers already, or at least if they don't know the fundamental questions, there's no way that average Americans are really in control of their own government, their own society.
That's right. No way. And right now, folks, okay, the key is for each and every one of us to learn more about the Constitution. And folks, I would urge you to start in your own town. Because if you start in your own town, okay, you take a sphere of energy, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And if right across the country, you start in your own town, it's a great place to start. Listen, folks, go to our website at tfnn.com. This is an unbelievable book, folks, bar none, okay? Go to the contributor page. It's $59. I mean, you must be selling it at a loss. You gotta be. You're awesome, man. And just check it out. Go to Edward Vieira. Edward, thank you so much, man.
Thanks, Tom.
Really appreciate it. That's Edward Vieira, folks. Okay, it's called Pieces of Eight. And we all have a great time out here, folks. Okay, I love life. I absolutely love it. I love what I'm doing. I love everything about it. Okay, and you know, we gotta get jazzed about this. What we have to do is we have to get educated about it. And put up a fight about it. And yes, okay, it's the whole system, but you know what? Piece by piece, people want to do the right thing, folks. This is complex.
Would you like to be...
education on the monetary powers and disabilities of the United States Constitution. Edward, how you doing?
Good, Tom. How about you?
I'm doing great, man.
Yeah, you sound fine.
I'm doing great. You know, it's wild. Is that I didn't know, you know, we put together an archive of, let's see, I think it was the first three or four that you and I had been talking. So we put it together in an hour show. I played it once before, but people actually loved it. So I'm going to play it tomorrow afternoon.
Wonderful.
And we do these, you know, what I plan on doing is put it in fact, I'll email them over to you because they're an MP3, so you can take a look at them. But let's get moving with, you know, what we have happening out here. We've been getting, Brian, on a huge education from you, and it seems like the system in general is, the fiat system is just getting larger and larger and larger every day.
Well, it has to.
Yeah, right.
I mean, on the basis of its own theory.
Right.
It has to. Fundamentally, it follows the lines of the Ponzi system. You've got to keep bringing new players in and justifying that by expansion of currency and credit, or in the reverse, I mean, you expand currency and credit, and then you justify that by bringing new players in and expanding the market. That's the absolute necessity. If you once turn around from that system and you begin to move in the direction of contraction, well, then, of course, all bets are off. And we see something potentially that could look catastrophic. That's always been the history of these systems, that once the contraction begins to move in a direction, or speed, I should say, so the same direction, but the
yes.
speed that's beyond the ability of the issuers to reverse or at least to hold, then you have catastrophic economic events. And those depressions, so-called, occurred many times in the 19th century. And, of course, then we had a number of them in the 20th century, and the biggest one being the one of the 1930s. Now, we don't call them depressions anymore, and we have these reverses. We call them recessions, or we call them stagnations, or what have you. We simply haven't had one big enough, I suppose, for them to attach the word depression to it. But that's the fear that always looms in the background to the people that are managing these types of systems.
How long has the fiat currency lasted last couple thousand years? How long has a paper currency lasted in society, I guess?
Well, they tend not to last too long. You're talking usually on the outside, it's the space of about a generation. I mean, sometimes they go for just a few years. But if it lasts as long as a generation. Now, the interesting thing about the fiat currency that we have today is, first, it came into existence only finally in 1971.
Oh, that's what you feel. Oh, this is interesting. Okay, cool.
All right.
I'm with you there.
All right, we can go back to
this is really important. Okay.
Right. We can go back to the 1930s and say, well, 1930s was the period in which the United States, people like to say, went off the gold standard.
Okay.
Well, that really isn't true stated that way because it's too general. In the first place, domestically speaking, individuals were deprived of their actual gold coins, or if they had gold bullion, if they had gold certificates, the paper currency that was redeemable in gold coins.
Yes.
They were deprived of that. It was illegal for Americans to hold gold domestically. But internationally, Federal Reserve notes were still being settled, those balances were still being settled in gold. And actually, there was a terrific influx of gold during the 30s and then, of course, the 40s into the United States because this was the most stable economy then in the entire world. So the Federal Reserve's gold position actually went up rather than down. Gold was not thrown out of the system. It was just limited to the foreign settlements.
Oh, this is so cool. Folks, what Edward's explaining here, and this is really, you want to get this in your head, you know, meaning that fiat currency, folks, as he said, stays a generation. You know, and I was looking at that, Ed, and I said to myself, boy, this fiat system has stayed for quite a while because, of course, I was into the perception that, you know, it was 1930. But what happened here, folks, is that you and I couldn't own gold, but what happened is that if a foreign country had their dollars, well, they could go to the Fed, they could go to that window and say, I want my gold. And that's what happened with Nixon, why he had to take us off, because all the foreign countries were coming to our window saying, I want your gold. And Nixon said, oh, I don't want to play this game anymore. You're going to take all our gold.
Well, that's right. And that was always the limitation. One has to remember this. There was always a limitation on a fiat system because there was some kind of alternative currency that was circulating in other areas, and people could walk away from the fiat currency and they could use this other currency. Then, of course, the purchasing power of the fiat currency would drop even if it weren't increasing in volume. Now, the peculiar thing, since 1971, of course, by 1971, as a result of the Bretton Woods Agreement, which came out of World War II, Federal Reserve notes were, for all intents and purposes, the world reserve currency. So the United States, even though it was not redeeming those things in gold anywhere, domestically or internationally, we were in a position essentially to export our inflation, our increases in Federal Reserve note currency and credit into other markets in the world.
Yes.
And as a result of that, you did not see what generally happens with fiat currencies historically, as more of them are generated, whether it's in terms of bank deposits or in terms of currency itself, you get what people call price inflation. All right, purchasing power of that money goes down. You didn't see that same effect because this stuff was going overseas and it was being used, quote-unquote, as a hard currency
right.
in other countries, right, that had worse inflationary problems. Well, now it's all out there, all right? And obviously, Mr. Greenspan, the central banking system, let's not lay it all on his shoulders, the central banking system has been expanding this currency base rather precipitously,
yeah.
Let's say since 1970, you pick whatever date you want, 1971, 72, that point till now. It's been expanding terrifically. But it has not had pressure coming back on it from the other side because there were no other competing currencies that were, what shall we say, of equivalent value
right.
that people would run into. Like you had some period with the Deutsche Mark and you had some with the yen and so forth and so on. But those are currencies that are they circulate in a smaller area. Well, now we have an interesting situation coming up with the euro if that thing survives.
Yes.
What will be the effect of the euro if it develops as a quality competing currency with the Federal Reserve note? Also, that's one thing right there. This system was able to expand because of the peculiar historical events that occurred following World War II. Now, the other side of this coin, of course, is given that there were very few or no significant pressures on the other side, this system has expanded probably quite a bit more, relatively speaking, than other fiat systems in history. That is, the bubble is bigger, the danger is bigger, because there has been no restraining influence.
Interesting.
Right?
Absolutely, right.
When you can export all of your bad inflationary effects to other parts of the world, you're not going to be restrained in generating those effects. And so that's what happened. So they have created, although on the one hand it seems, look, this is the most important currency, we're so powerful, blah, 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 yes. But as a result of that, because of the inherent instability of this system, we've created a much more dangerous potential of it.
You know, folks, this is incredible what Ed and Sam, because in you know, let's say in the 1500s or 1600s, what an emperor would do, and that's where they go conquer lands, and they'd conquer lands to go get the gold, go get the silver, go get their riches. But the fact of the matter is, we didn't have to conquer those lands. These people start taking our dollars. I mean, that's unbelievable. I understand what you're saying. I'm saying to myself, oh my God, I'm going back in my history books. I'm saying to myself, this is unbelievable how we actually did it. They, you know, we didn't have to go in there. They took our dollars, and now they're trapped like rats.
Well, it was financial imperialism, if you want to give it a name. But think of the other side of that coin now. Those people took Federal Reserve note currency or used bank deposits that paid in Federal Reserve note because they believed that that was a superior currency to the alternatives they had.
Yes.
What happens if they lose confidence in this system? Well, they're going to say to themselves, the one country where we can actually come back and require them to take this stuff is the United States, right?
Right.
And they will then expatriate that currency from their own country, bring it in here in a huge volume, and then what effect will that have on prices in this country?
Right.
Massive inflation, as the people use that term. Right. Massive price increases. So you could have a situation where the purchasing power of the Federal Reserve note would fall through the floor without one more piece of paper being printed by the Treasury if sufficient of that foreign liquidity comes pouring back into this country as a result of a loss of confidence.
Because,
you see, we're walking on broken glass.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
To use an analogy. This depends upon so the stability of this system depends not only upon how clever Mr. Greenspan may be or the people who are filling his position, but it depends upon confidence, not only confidence in the people in this country, in their own monetary system and political system, but confidence of the people in foreign countries. And some of those foreign countries, they may lose confidence in the United States for all sorts of reasons totally unconnected to the economic reality of the situation.
Oh, listen, yeah, there's no doubt about it. And you know, the bottom line, could you imagine? There's no way, okay, that if I was in a situation and I thought we're going to invade them in a second, you're not going to get dollars. We're going to get dollars for you. You're not going to help anyone. I mean, what you're going to do is you're either going to get gold, you're going to get something that's a hard asset other than helping in the person's on the other side of you. Forget it. You know,
that's right.
The euro, right? Now, the euro is a total fiat currency also, right?
Yeah, it's equivalent to the Federal Reserve note in terms of its quality, if
exactly.
you will.
Exactly. Okay, so the battle could set up, of course, the battle's being set up between the euro and the dollar. Because,
that's right.
Yeah.
And that's for political reasons, because, of course, the Europeans, or the people, I should say, the Europeans, people in charge of that central structure that makes up the European Union.
Yes.
That political group wants to get out from under the dollar imperialism and dollar control. And so it wants to set up the euro as a truly competing currency.
Right.
And that's, I think, as much for political reasons as for economic reasons, really.
Yeah.
And of course, political reasons are essentially non-rational, right?
Right.
Anytime people do things politically that have bad economic effects, they don't think about the bad economic effects because they're driven by these political designs.
Yes.
But it has not been established, obviously, that the euro is going to succeed in becoming a competing currency.
Yeah, and it's a politics. So remember something, folks. You know, someone always wants to control something, and the political reality is that it comes into play. You know, when I look at all of this, how it comes down, you know, fiat-wise, and when we get into the Federal Reserve, and you can get into, okay, you know, who owns the Fed, and, you know, what's really behind it, banker-wise, I look at this, and I'm saying to myself, you know what? All they really have to do, now this is not, let me throw it out here, okay, is that it's almost like the United States basically screwed up their master plan because, number one, it probably shouldn't have got so powerful. Number two, there shouldn't have been people, you know, like you or other entrepreneurs out there that are in their way to really make it an expansion in a huge way. Do you know what I'm saying? And right now, you know, the Fed has us, but they only have us so far because of the Constitution. Now, this is bring us back to the Constitution, I guess, right? And the way that they could get rid of all of that is the financial destruction of the middle class, basically. Whether that comes down, and the one way it can come down, of course, is that, you know, the currency getting absolutely croaked.
And just remember, they have been taking all sorts of steps, not simply financial, to squeeze the middle class
Absolutely.
For several generations.
Right.
That is part of somebody's agenda.
Yeah, it is. It really is. It's unbelievable. Listen, folks, it's Pieces of Eight. This is an unbelievable book, folks. It's actually a great encyclopedia. It's two books, folks. It's approximately 1,600 pages. Go to our website at tfnn.com. Go to the contributor page. Edward Vieira, you know, latch on there. It's only $59.95. It's a great work of art. Listen, you have a great fourth, man, okay?
You too, Tom. Take
care.
Have a
great one. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
It's Edward Vieira every Wednesday, folks, tomorrow at 5 o'clock, okay, the 5 to 6 hour. We're going to have Edward on, the last, the three conversations we have at the full hour. I am going to be taking off tomorrow's market close at 1, and, of course, Friday we are off. We're going to be right back, folks.